Welcome to a new episode of the Life Science Get Together podcast. Today with a very special topic. A couple of years ago, it came to my awareness that in the United States, a fund exists. It's called the ARC Fund, founded by Kathy Wood in 2014. And she has an investment approach that I very much appreciate. It's investing in high-tech and deep-tech companies. And she has put together a research team that is on the lookout for game-changing technology since 2014. And the nice thing with her fund and her team is that every year she issues a report, which she calls Big Ideas Report, in which she dissects with her team the five platforms of innovation she has identified and of which she believes that they will shape our society in the coming one or two decades. And amongst these platforms of innovation, there is one life science application. She calls it the genomics revolution, and everything around gene editing, gene sequencing, the therapies connected to what she calls genomics revolutions, and also diagnostics is analyzed by her team every year. So I asked myself, what is this hype all about genomics, CRISPR technology, and there are so many new terms on the market that I was looking for experts from my network, and actually, interestingly, I found them here in Vienna, in Austria. And I'm very happy today that I can welcome to this episode two experts from Vienna, Austria, and Germany. It's Thomas Moser and Tilman Bürgstümer from Alien Biotech. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Christian, for having us.
Great to be here.
Good to see you. Let me ask you one initial question first. What is your background?
Yeah, if I may start. So my background is in genetics. So I studied in Salzburg, then did my PhD in developmental biology, then went into industry for a few years, and then moved to Vienna to work as a technology licensing officer for Austrian universities, which was a quite interesting task these days. This was late 90s, because this was also the time when the Austrian biotech scene really evolved. And I also got drawn into this field of seed financing, and by my colleagues, because we also had a fund that invested into this area. And one of the first business plans I got on my table was from Intercell, which back in these days made the first financing round. So it was really super exciting times. And in the coming years, I have grown into this role. And in the end, we managed our own venture capital fund and invested into early stage companies. But after some time, I went back into the operational area again. Early 2014, I went into the biotech scene again as an operational manager, and together with Tilman, we managed a spin-off of another biotech company called Haplogen Genomics in the area of gene-edited cell lines. And this startup was reasonably successful. Within a short time period, we could sell this to Horizon Discovery, UK-based company, which was back in the days really considered one of the main tech company being active in this area of gene editing, and having a very strong also IP base in this area. And then it was quite exciting time. We worked for 3 years for this UK company. But after some time, as you know, it's interesting to work with these medium-sized to big companies. But after some time, as an entrepreneur, you want to take your own fate again and decide and make the decisions on your own. And that's why we then founded our own company again, which we probably will discuss later on, which was called Beginning 2018. We started Alien Biotechnology, which has developed since then quite well.
Thank you very much for the introduction. I completely agree to your statement that working with big corporations is a completely different world than evolving a new idea from the ideation phase into the pre-seed and seed stage and first financing rounds. And it's a different world.
Absolutely.
Tilman, where are you coming from?
Yeah, I'm a biochemist by training. Did a PhD in Berlin on virology, host virus interaction, and then came to Vienna as a postdoc where I joined Giulio Soperti-Furga's lab. And after some time there, Giulio asked me whether I wanted to join Haplogen as the first scientist. And that was sort of a very exciting prospect to join a newly founded company that back in the days was really sort of being built. And so then I spent essentially 3-4 years at Haplogen, and that was around the time then when CRISPR came to the scene, and we very quickly realized that this was going to be a game-changing technology, and started using it early in 2013. So that was really around the time the first papers suggested that this could be used in mammalian cells, and very quickly built what back in the days was the largest collection of knockout cell lines available sort of to date. And that was then the basis for the acquisition by Horizon Discovery. And then at Horizon, I had various roles in R&D, essentially driving technology development. I had sort of teams in Cambridge, teams in Vienna, and in the end was in charge of innovation across the entire company, which was sort of had a US site, a UK site, and a site in Vienna. And then sort of recently, as Thomas pointed out, we bought it off and we founded our own company early 2018. And really the main driver there was to get back into the driver's seat. I mean, that was really the thing that that in a bigger organization is, you know, once you've had the privilege, let's say, to work in a small efficient organization where decision making works and you're sort of used to that, it's not easy to find yourself in a bigger organization where everything needs a committee and sort of different people weigh in, people point out caveats, and then, you know, nothing happens. We're very much enjoying, I think, that flexibility and agility that we now have back.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You love listening to podcasts, but have you ever thought about starting your own podcast? Maybe you want to build a brand, grow your business, or are looking for an excuse to talk about your favorite hobby. Whatever your reason for making a podcast, Buzzsprout is the place to start. Since 2009, Buzzsprout has helped over 300,000 people launch their own podcasts. Buzzsprout walks you step by step through the whole process and will give you powerful tools to start, grow, and monetize your podcast. Ready to get started? Click the link in the show notes to get our free step-by-step guide to starting your podcast today.
Amazing points. We are trading safety and security for the excitement of the startup world. So let's put it that way. You explained that you founded in 2018 your current company. It's named Alien Biotechnology. Where is the name coming from?
This was an interesting process to find the name for the company. Basically, it can be tracked back to a Greek scholar called Elianos, who was a famous natural scientist that back in the days, and who had did some landmark kind of books in characterizing the fauna and flora of the ancient Greek, and we felt that this is a good characterization what we do with our technology base. So it's really about going into the mechanisms of life and of cells, and that's what we can essentially do with our technology base and platform. Therefore, we felt this was quite a suitable name for our company.
I like all names that begin with A. I think it's a tremendous advantage for companies that need to attend conferences, because when I get the company names listed alphabetically and I want to reach out to, it doesn't matter if it's investor or pharma companies, they always start every conference with A. And when there are 2,000 companies at this event, then I end up somewhere at C or something.
Yeah.
So I always, it comes to my mind, names beginning with A have an advantage in our world.
That's why the companies now start with numbers. This is even more
famous. Let's take it up a notch, or with a point or with bracket marks. What is the core focus of Alien Biotechnology? What is your business?
Yeah, so the core focus is really to bring together these two landmark technologies. One on the is obviously the gene scissors CRISPR technology. I think we will go into detail later on that. But the other very important part is this single cell component that forms an important part of our technology portfolio, and we bring this together. What this means, what does this single cell resolution and revolution mean? So if you think of a tumor biopsy, then as a biologist or a medical doctor, you are probably aware that the biopsy that you take from a tumor creates many different cell types. So you have some cells that are kind of necrotic, that are that have died. You have some fibrotic tissue. You have different blood cells maybe, and you have the tumor cells. So if you analyze this whole tumor sample, you always look at the average between all these different cell types. So the analysis in the end is somehow average, the signal may be weaker. What you can do with single cell technologies, that you really look at each single cell, and this provides superior resolution. And therefore, if you are able to only look at the tumor tissue, you can learn a lot from that, because the signal is not blurred by some other cell types that you're not interested in. And what we take this approach one step further, in that we perturb genes in single cells and look at the consequences this genetic perturbation has on the phenotype of the cell. And what we can do with that is really to look for new targets for new therapeutics with really unprecedented resolution. And that's obviously of very big interest for many international cooperation partners like big pharma companies, biotech companies. I mean, it's a super specialized business. I think we have built a very significant know-how in this area. It's very specialized, and therefore, yeah, we feel we are on a good track. I think the kind of secret in these days is really to have a kind of special topic that you work on and really focus on that. And we have built a team of, we are more than 30 people now that really exclusively focus on this very special topic. And I feel we really could create very interesting partnerships through this technology base.
Tilman, do you want to add to this great explanation?
No, I think Thomas summarized it very well. It's really the single cell topic, which is married, if you like, with CRISPR. And I think what's interesting for a startup initially, as they say, you know, it's important that you work in a relatively small niche, because you're very few people. So you need to focus on something, and ideally that something is quite narrow. And then, you know, in our case, we sort of started in this space when the field was much less developed, and we were sort of betting on this field, on the expansion of this field. And this is what we're really seeing after sort of being in this business for 2-3 years. There's a lot of excitement in single cell technologies, and people really appreciate that we cannot just grind up tissues or grind up cells and sort of average above them, but we really need to learn sort of from the individual cell what's going on, because these cells differ very much. It's like looking at a group of people, right? You can now say, oh, we look at all the faces individually, or we create sort of an average phase. The average phase will maybe tell you a little bit, right? Are we in Western Europe or in Africa? So it's not, there's still information in that, but looking at the individual faces will sort of give you a lot more flavor and will reveal a lot more information. And then the other bit is really the CRISPR allows us to provide causative data. And that's very important and very powerful, because a lot of the other techniques that are out there, you know, for instance, single cell sequencing on its own is essentially a descriptive technology. It's a technology that looks at, you know, cellular properties, reports the cellular properties, but they really are, there is no sort of way to say why a cell developed in this way or developed in another way. What CRISPR allows us to do is change gene expression, change one gene in a cell very specifically, and look at the functional consequences of that. So that, you know, establishes then a causative relationship between that gene and the change we observe. And such data are still very scarce, right? A lot of people out there, even in the target discovery and target validation space, they will look at large epidemiological studies. They will look at population genetics. They will look at, you know, often very biased starting points like, oh, let's look at the papers that people have published in the past 5 years. But to have an unbiased start, provide a data set that provides causative relationships, that I think is very strong. And that's why we're seeing sort of growing interest in our technology from sort of pharma and biotech companies.
That's amazing. You mentioned a little bit the business side of life in your opening speech. And let's, before we dive deeper into CRISPR and gene editing and gene sequencing, let's dive a little bit also into the business model of life science companies. Mm-hmm. I'm coming from business background and started to learn more about this B2B value chain in 2006 when I joined Nobreva, a Novartis spin-out. And the first few years in life science were scary because it's a very, very unique value chain and a very, very unique, sort of business models that I learned to appreciate. But unfortunately, they are not very well documented. So it would be really great to get more insights into how you have set up the business side of Alien Biotechnology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, obviously, this is one of the most important points in when we formed our company and we gave this significant consideration. Yeah, so as you already pointed out, in biotech, there are many, many different business models. And yeah, also in my life as an investor, I saw many, many companies and many different business models. So obviously, yeah, if you do it on your own, you want to make it better than others. So we have set up Alien as it is. And this basically, at least where we stand for now, is a status where we perform this functional genomic screens, as we call it, for big pharma and biotech companies. And we get a certain chunk of the value chain of these results of these screens. And these screens are, as we said before, these are typically used for target discovery. So you can find new points and proteins within the cell where therapeutics can be developed. And you learn also a lot about mechanisms of disease. So on the one side, we can generate these data and results out of the screens. And on the other side, obviously, we are a very specialized technology platform company. We develop sustainable intellectual property out of these screens, because this whole field, obviously, as you can imagine, is developing at a very high speed. So the best organizations on the East and West Coast are active in this area and have a focus on this. So the pressure on staying ahead is really significant. But as we have a very focused team in this area, we can afford doing that and really staying on top of the technology development. Yeah, so that's basically our business model. We obviously generate cash flows and revenues in the project with our international customers. It's a very international business, so I think we only have one customer in continental Europe. It's really the main markets in US, UK, Japan, where our cooperation partners are located. And with these, we typically work on a project basis of, let's say, typical projects have a duration of, let's say, 9 to 18 months. And within such projects, we develop this technology further and generate the results that we described before.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Money is all around us, and we think about it more than almost every other aspect of our lives. But how can we make more of it, and what's our drive for building wealth beyond just the numbers in our bank account? Join us on the Make More podcast as our host Matt Heslin brings to you a dynamic lineup of experts in the world of investing, business, health, and beyond. Together, they unpack the secrets to not just surviving, but thriving in today's economy. It's about more than just wealth. It's about crafting life experiences, seizing opportunities, and building a legacy. Subscribe now to the Make More with Matt Heslin podcast and join us every week for new expert insights and inspiration.
Yeah, and maybe to add to this, I think there are always different ways to sort of make a business out of technology. And one other sort of recent development that we're very excited about is that we founded a spin-off, a daughter company, together with a Cambridge, UK-based biotech named BitBio. And in this daughter company, we sort of carved out a particular area in this specific case. It's stem cell biology. There's a lot of and growing interest in human stem cells for various applications, certainly for gene and cell therapy, but also as research models and tools. And we said, the technology that we have developed at Alien has sort of very interesting applications in this space. And this application has gotten so big that together with a partner, we're actually setting up a separate vehicle, a separate company. And within that company, where we're both managing directors as well, we're really driving the development of novel stem cell types that can, well, not stem cell types, novel cell types as they can be obtained from stem cells. And that vehicle, because if it was such great interest to us and to our partners in Cambridge, sort of was then co-funded by the partner in Cambridge. So we think that's another interesting way of sort of getting technology funded. It can be sort of projects that run for a certain duration and then they end, but it can be that these projects become big and important enough so that you can actually set up a separate company with a dedicated team that will grow this additional application of the technology and that secures separate funding in this entity.
That's great to hear. Congratulations. So you did it twice. One, the first foundation in 2018, back into the startup world. And then the second one, which year was it?
Yeah, the second
this
one
was in September. Yeah, September last year only. Yeah. So, but it's somehow linked. So kind of
So it's not the real foundation side.
No, I mean, although it's a separate company, it's a separate entity, and obviously have to recruit the team there, but we felt in this very special case that this really makes sense to form an own entity really for the work to be done in stem cells and cell types derived from these stem cells, because maybe this should be mentioned as well, that kind of the bracket that keeps all the work at Alien together as well is really this focus on cellular models that are highly physiologically relevant. What we mean by that is that the cellular models we work with, we feel, are much better suited than the typically used immortalized cancer lines that are used in pharma and biotech research and development. So the goal really is to have something, a model that can be well translated into human trials in the end with a much higher probability than this typically used cancer cell lines, which in many cases have very weird genomes, have lots of mutations. Even the fact that they grow unlimited is not natural. Every cell that you take out of the human body is typically quite limited in lifespan. So this is an important focus of our work as well. I mean, which means that's super challenging, because on the one side in Alien, we work in primary T cells. So you take blood from the patient, extract these cells and cultivate them. So you can easily imagine that's very challenging, but we have managed these very tough points, and our team has established the systems, and therefore we can perform our kind of other technologies now in these advanced cell line models.
That's great. So basically, instead of founding a second division in your company, you decided to spin it out, get it financed separately, and keep with both entities your particular core focus on the market, so that the storytelling is not diluted with an approach that might, when we look at it in one company, might a little bit raise questions why it is in one part.
Yeah.
When I understand your approach, it's a B2B business model. In which you are, accumulating expertise in the company, in the field, around these two topics of your companies. And then you approach the pharma industry and enter into research collaborations with them, which I assume is not, a week or so. Am I right with my assumption that these are multi-years collaborations down the road that consist of several projects and are not, like buying a used car, so that you approached once. So they really want to understand, get your expertise in the fields that they don't have.
Right.
Do you, and I also assume that they cover the expenses and the cost, do you also participate in the upside? I mean, if something evolves into a product later on?
Yeah, and existing partnerships, we don't have this yet, but you're making a very good point. Obviously, this is the goal for the future, that we participate in the downstream value creation in terms of percentages of milestones and also maybe royalties. But this is a bit dependent on the phase of the company. Obviously, in the beginning, it was important for us to get Alien off the ground and really establish ourselves as a major technology player in this very special field. And we have gained significant traction in the meantime. I mean, recently we could communicate that we are doing three large projects with GSK.
And, congratulations.
This was really a major step forward for Alien. And this also probably gives us a lot of credibility. But as you rightly pointed out, these are long projects that take many months and also involve a lot on our side. And in the next projects that we will get on board, definitely this participation on the downstream side is important for us. In addition, the the improvement of the technology base is a value on its own. So we obviously apply for patents in this space, certain patents on parts of the workflow. Mm-hmm. Have been applied for, and they contribute to this building of a sustainable value position for Alien. Besides this other leg that Tilman already mentioned, forming joint ventures with specialized partners for specific topics, which has already been exemplified for the stem cells, but that could also be true for certain therapeutic areas.
Yeah, IP protection should not be underestimated. So it can create a really nice moat around the business and drive the value when the IP strategy is set up very well, especially if it's a new field, which I consider CRISPR and gene editing still is rather new and mostly unprotected. When I think about the typical startup that I meet at incubation or acceleration programs these days, first, they present the business plan, and the second, their will to reach out to investors for investment. And what I find interesting in your story, it sounds to me that you did it the other way around. So, I mean, you established your expertise, your business plan, and then went right to the customer. Or did they overhear that you also were in talks with investors and got investment money? What was your strategy in funding the initial days?
We were in a kind of... very privileged position. On the one side, this was not our first company, so we have seen lots of companies before and have gained significant experience before. And also, as I said before, our 3 years at working for this UK-based Horizon Discovery company was really kind of very important times for us, because we could really expand our international networks to customers, to distribution partners. And obviously, this helped us in setting up Alien later on then. So in terms of financing, we did not really make big financing rounds. We have a bit of business angel money on board, which comes from a friend. And besides that, we don't have institutional capital on board. Because we were in this kind of privileged position that we really could fund us right from the beginning with significant project money coming from our cooperation partners. But yeah, obviously this would not rule out that in one of the maybe JVs that we plan for the future, then that we bring in VC money there for therapeutic developments that could be done in such a auto company.
I mean, for the time being, I would add we're really enjoying the fact that we have independence there. We don't have a board or investors that we need to meet on a monthly basis, provide reports, answer questions, right? We can really decide what we think is right for the company. On the other hand, it means that we are focusing on the clients. This is also a good point, because it allowed us sort of from the first day to get real world feedback, right? We were not in a position to develop something for 2-3 years only to learn that nobody really needs this, right? Because we were dependent on money flowing in from people that want to work with us, we had to be sure that what we're developing is sort of in a very short period of time going to be, maybe not monetized, but is going to be needed, right? So a lot of our developments are guided by customer needs. And because we have that direct interaction from day one, we're really not falling into the trap of developing something that we think is incredibly cool, and then it maybe isn't.
Testing the market is always a good idea. I got my training in the 90s, and the typical business model back then was develop a prototype, find a customer. So once you have the first customer, it's validation enough, and then look for growth capital. When I look at the investment world today, especially in the early days, I think it's a little bit the upside down. It's develop a pitch deck, find an investor, and then hopefully you come to a prototype and later on you find a customer or other investors. So it's an interesting direction. However, what I saw when I entered the life science industry, I mean, of course, scientists were excited about new technologies. It helped to improve their processes, their product development processes. That's cool. But in 2014, 15, 16, and especially in 18 and 19, this CRISPR and gene editing did something amazing compared to other technologies. I mean, other technologies mostly stay hidden, and the usual retail investor from the streets or the usual investment fund is not very interested in that. Not so with CRISPR, and not so with gene editing and gene sequencing, as I said in the initial in the opening of the podcast episode. The ARK funds are a huge fan of the genomics revolution. Can you explain to the average investor a little bit what this excitement is all about, why gene editing is so different to other technologies in our industry?
Yeah, I can try that. So essentially, we know sort of since the completion of the Human Genome Project, which was first sort of completed in 2001, I believe. What we know since the completion of the human genome is we know the building blocks of the cell and of the human body, the so-called genes, right? And we have 20,000 of them. And we essentially know that drugs act on gene products. So they take a product, a protein in a cell that is encoded by a gene, and they modulate it. And as a consequence of that, we can treat disease. But, you know, until the advent of CRISPR, we really had no way of manipulating genes, let's say, in a faithful way. There were sort of other technologies out there that could try to do this. You know, for the aficionados, this was RNA interference. It sort of worked a little bit, but not really. And what's exciting about CRISPR is that we're now able to do this. And this gives us sort of two, I think, angles or two opportunities that we couldn't tap into. One is, you know, for the researchers in the lab, we can now ask, what does that gene do in a cell, right? It's a very fundamental question. And if I have a hypothesis as to whether this gene is a target of a drug, I can ask, does sort of targeting this gene or targeting this gene product, does that make a good drug, right? And that's super important because the drug discovery process is a very long one. It takes sort of, you know, if it's not the COVID vaccine, it usually takes sort of something like 10 years to go from nominating a target to having a drug on the market, if not longer. And so the nomination at the beginning is sort of the critical starting point. And if you don't get it right at that point, you will do 10 years of, you know, medicinal chemistry and toxicology and you name it, but the drug will not do what it's supposed to do. So sort of that is the first angle that I think is super exciting, that we now have a tool that at least conceptually or potentially allows us to nail the most important drug targets and thereby increase the chance of a drug to be successful. The second is if you want to take that thought a little further, you know, in basic biology or in basic science, it's very similar. We you know, people are looking at a process. Let's say you're a researcher studying diabetes, right? You suddenly have a way of finding out whether a gene has a role in diabetes or not. That's what the basic science uses CRISPR for. And then sort of the future of CRISPR is really not only as a tool to discover new drugs, but is, you know, CRISPR could become the drug itself. So we could face a situation where you have probably the simplest model is you have a gene defect, right? You might have sickle cell anemia. That's a common one that people are interested in these days. It's a blood disorder. So your blood cells, sort of in this case, your red blood cells are dysfunctional. And that is functional because you have an error in your genome, in a particular gene. And this error, you know, people know for decades, but there's nothing you can do about it. Right? That's the sad thing. It's very similar about many other hereditary disorders, right? You find out your kid has Duchenne muscular dystrophy. You can precisely map it to the mutation, but there's nothing you can do about it. And the exciting prospect about CRISPR is you might be able to correct this mistake, if you like, or this error in the genome, and thereby cure disease. Of course, there's a lot of technical hurdles in the way, so it will not be something that will happen tomorrow, but at least conceptually, that's why it's so exciting. Any disease that's caused by a defect in a gene, and there are many of those that we know and that a lot of people have heard of, you know, cystic fibrosis. I mean, it's a long list. It's hundreds, if not thousands of disorders. Those we can potentially treat and potentially cure with CRISPR. And that is just unheard of. There was no sort of similar development, I would say, in a long period of time that opened up such a vast field as gene editing did.
And maybe to add to this, also from a mechanistic point of view, the system is very elegant and relatively easy to use. I mean, there were systems around that could be used for similar purposes for editing the genome very specifically, but these were complicated and very specific. And with CRISPR, you basically have a protein that is kind of programmed by a short stretch of a nucleic acid, which can be easily synthesized in any lab. And you bring this together, if you tell it very simply, and you can make a genome edit. And this ease of access also contributed to this hype around this CRISPR editing that only can be compared to polymerase chain reaction, this gene amplification that, yeah, also was maybe the latest landmark invention in biology before CRISPR.
So when I put it bluntly, on one hand, there is excitement about the diagnostics and understanding the development of diseases better, especially those that are rooted in genetics and have their causes so that you really can trace back which gene plays which role in what disease at what point of the development of the disease. And the second is that you correct it. So that you go into the therapeutics field and say, okay, when we identify the problem, why not solve it? When was all this developed? What is the history of gene editing? I don't think it comes out of nowhere that in 2013 suddenly someone woke up and said, let's do gene editing. Can you give a little bit more information on the history of this technology?
Yeah, so the history, you know, very briefly is that already quite some time ago, people noticed that in bacteria, there are certain regions that contain repeats, and you know, people found these repeats and they were not quite sure what they were and what they were for. But already quite early on, people suspected that these might have to do with immunity. And sort of one key insight was then that, so repeat is essentially a 20 base pair sequence in the genome that is sort of duplicated. But between those repeats, there were sequences. And when people first sequenced those, they realized that these sequences between those repeats came from bacteriophages. Now, bacteriophages are essentially the viruses that infect bacteria. So that sort of meant, or that sort of strongly pointed to these repeats being involved in immunity, right? Because these are sequences found in a bacterium, but they're not from the bacterium. They're from the phage that infects the bacterium. So it sort of reminds us of immunity that you know, much like we know it in humans. And then the key insight came really that sort of got this entire field to sort of heat up and become very exciting came from the discovery that there was an enzyme. This is the enzyme called Cas9. And what this enzyme could do is it could take these sequences that, you know, in the bacterium come from the bacteriophage, and they could essentially trigger a DNA double-strand break in a sequence that's complementary to the sequence inserted between the repeats. So what that meant is if the phage comes in, you know, the bacterium has seen that phage before, remembers it because that sequence is integrated between those repeats. It can take those sequences, match them to the phage DNA, and the phage gets destroyed. It gets cut and cleaved by this enzyme Cas9. That was sort of the key piece of the puzzle. And sort of people had figured parts of the puzzle out before. Obviously, it was sort of an entire field with a lot of people contributing. But the key insight for which then Emmanuel Charpentier and Jennifer Doudna were awarded the Nobel Prize last year was they were able to take all the components that were needed in the system and make them in vitro. So make the Cas9 endonuclease in bacteria, make a so-called guide RNA. This is this RNA molecule with a repeat sequences, put that together in a petri dish or in that case in an Eppendorf tube, and show that this could trigger programmed targeted cleavage of the reaction that is of the DNA that's complementary to the guide RNA that you put in. So they sort of identified the minimal components of the system and said this is what we need to make it work. And then obviously people could take this very quickly and make it work in human cells, in plant cells, in animal cells, and so on and so forth. But that key insight, that was really what got the field started. This is a paper they published late in 2012. It's actually work initiated here in Vienna by Chris Jelinski, PhD student in Emmanuel Charpentier's lab when she was still in Vienna. But then the work sort of was completed when she was in Sweden. And there was sort of a partner effort at Berkeley where Jennifer Doudna was based together with her PhD student, Martin Ginek, who is today a professor in Zurich.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Coaching Conversation 2024. This podcast is 100% dedicated to leadership and leadership within the workplace coaching area. We work with companies throughout the world teaching leaders how to coach their employees. This podcast is dedicated to teaching specific strategies, frameworks, coaching models, and now artificial intelligence strategies to help leaders drive greater teamwork, collaboration, cooperation, greater attitudes, better motivation, coaching career development, just to name a few. I hope you'll check out our podcast.
That's amazing. So Vienna seems to play a key role in that field. When I look at the community, you are here. Then you mentioned Haplogen, the company that was also, I think, 2013 established. And then the company CRISPR Therapeutics is also run by Rutger Novak. And I think Emmanuel Charpentier is also still on the board of the company. Why is Vienna so attractive? Is this just pure luck or coincidence, or is there a special reason why CRISPR is leaving such a heavy impact on the industry here?
Yeah, I mean, first, as much as I like Alien and Haplogen, I think to name them in the same row as CRISPR Therapeutics or Emmanuel Charpentier is a bit of a big pair of shoes to wear. No, I think it's essentially
coincidence that you're all in the same city.
No, I think it is to some extent it is coincidence. Obviously, the fact that Rutger Novak was involved in and Emmanuel is involved in CRISPR Therapeutics is because Emmanuel had such an important role in discovering that. I think you could say that it was important for Vienna to have this group at the university, not only Emmanuel's group, but also sort of Pavel Kovarik, Thomas Decker, people that were focusing on bacterial genetics, right? Mm-hmm. That was sort of the key subject. These people didn't start to discover a novel gene editing tool, right? Particularly Emmanuel, she was a bacterial geneticist trying to understand what these repeats do in the bacterium, trying to understand bacterial immunity, if you like. So I think in that sense, that is probably Vienna's contribution, right? That they had this focus on bacterial genetics and that then whatever we learned from bacterial genetics could be translated and became a tool that now we're using for a different purpose. I think that is that was quite important, and the University of Vienna obviously is still involved because the intellectual property, which is the foundational IP, let's say, around the world, is still partly owned by the University of Vienna together with Berkeley and Emmanuel on her own, which is another interesting detail, because she moved to Sweden. In Sweden, academic researchers retain full rights on the IP they discover, which is different from the situation here, right? If you're a professor at the university and you make an important discovery, that is typically owned by the university. You get a share of that typically, but you don't own it, right? Whereas in Sweden, it's the other way around. So because she had moved to Sweden, which is probably the only place that has such an IP right, she actually personally owns that IP, up to this day. And obviously that had a significant financial impact, positive financial impact for Emmanuel, I assume.
I think it's very interesting to learn more about IP protection, different IP protection strategies, especially in the area of basic research. And it's really interesting. What I really like is to see how such ideas evolve. So first you have a small group, they start working on it. And if it works, then the industry just gets bigger and bigger and more companies evolve and more researchers are drawn in and everything grows naturally and effortlessly. It's also interesting to hear Vienna in the same sentence with Berkeley, for example, University of Vienna. It's there's a lot going on here in this city and in the heart of Europe, which is not so obviously marketed like digital advancements or app development. So I really like that. When I think about gene editing, I think when we're looking at the yellow press, there's also a lot of fear and discussions around that, if this is really good, if it's risky or dangerous. Can we talk a little bit about real life applications? So what this, just to give people more insight, what can we really do with gene editing and what is more on the superstitious side or on the fear-based side and not really realistic? What are some applications that you think about that this technology can really grow into?
Yeah, I mean, apart from the functional genomics, which is what we are doing, sort of trying to understand the functions of genes, I think the biggest hope is that one day we will be able to cure disease. You know, it's obvious, as you just pointed out, that this pertains to genetic disorders. We've talked about that a little bit, but it's also true that we might potentially treat cancer. And that is, you know, cancer also has certain dependencies on certain genes more than others. And we might be able to use CRISPR to switch off these genes that are either driving or supporting a cancer cell and thereby eliminate cancer. There's a lot of interest in an area called immuno-oncology, where what we can do is we can essentially take the blood from a patient or take immune cells as they reside in a tumor, and we can change them with CRISPR to sort of reawaken them, right? They're typically not very active against the tumor. That's part of the strategy, if you like, of the tumor to make them sort of not recognize the tumor, because the tumor in principle is something that in an ideal world would be considered foreign, so that the body gets rid of the tumor. But of course, the tumor has sort of, if you think of it in evolutionary terms, the tumor has an interest to stay hidden so that it can grow and it does not get attacked by immune cells. But these immune cells can be reawakened, and there are ways to do this with antibodies. They're very famous examples of antibodies, and that was sort of the basis for the Nobel Prize given in 2018 for antibodies, that if you give them to people, that reawaken these immune cells. But there is also a potential, because blood cells are readily available, right? You can take them out of the body. You could CRISPR engineer them and put them back into the body. There is excitement about this opportunity. And that is, I think, one of the things that is on the near-term horizon, that we might actually get sort of our customized tumor treatment where people take the cells out, reprogram them with CRISPR, put them back in. The thing that people are obviously afraid of is manipulation of the germline. So that means changing the sperm cells or oocytes so that we give rise to genetically engineered human beings. This has apparently been done in China, and there was an outcry for good reasons about this. I don't think this was a particularly good example, because the researchers eliminated a receptor that typically allows HIV to enter cells. So it's there are many different ways to treat HIV these days. So it's not needed to manipulate the genome of these babies so that they cannot get HIV anymore. So I think for the time being, there is a moratorium. Nobody is advocating the use of CRISPR in the germline. I think that is the state of the affairs. And I think it's good like that, right? We need to understand better the risks associated. And with risks, I mean, you know, this is CRISPR is sometimes described as a genome scissor. So you can imagine that the scissor comes in and it cuts somewhere, but then, you know, if the scissor is not so precise, it might cut somewhere else in the genome, which would potentially cause harm. And so that needs to be looked at very carefully before people consider something like germline treatment. So it's not on the horizon really, and there's nothing to be afraid of at this point, because the entire scientific community is acting very responsibly about it. There are clear bans, and you know, that is not a risk at this point.
I think it's very interesting, this idea that you pointed out of, let's say, reprogramming antibodies to which can help, just put it bluntly, reprogramming antibodies, you take it out of the body and give them a clear order how they should act in the body, and which could evolve into the potential of making cancer a manageable disease. So it must not be that patients then die from cancer, but simply can live and can manage the disease and stop it from growing, or also maybe also reverting the process so that it really is driven, let's say it's driven out of the body in simple words. Is that really a feasible goal? Do you see this direction that it really evolves into therapeutics that really have an impact, or is it just more like a combination therapy that you still have to use the toxins?
I think it's a really realistic opportunity. Obviously, we've seen the admission of the first so-called CAR therapies. Mm-hmm. These are T cells which are reprogrammed with an antibody on the surface so that they recognize a tumor cell that they could previously not recognize. And so these therapies are given to patients, and for particular types of cancer, particularly cancers of the B cell lineage, so that arise from antibody producing cells, these types of therapies are, you know, I would say quite good. However, I don't think realistically now, with the therapies that are being developed, there will not be an easy route into sort of a cure for cancer as a whole, right? Cancer is a very heterogeneous disease depending on where it arises. But even then, if you look at all the breast cancers, there are some that are quite manageable these days with drugs, and others are really poorly manageable. And to think that there will be one treatment that sort of one for all, I mean, that I don't think is realistic. But to I think since the discovery of CRISPR, the field of cell therapy, so to think of a cell as a therapeutic agent, right? That is sort of, I think, a concept that with the advent of CRISPR is becoming a reality. And you know, we're seeing more and more examples of, I would say, clinical trials where people explore the feasibility of that. And my anticipation is that in 5 years' time, we'll have a bunch of these, and in 10 years' time, we'll have more. So it's a growing field, and the prospect is very exciting. So the prospect is that we might actually be able to treat diseases, because there are clearly cases where we've not made a lot of progress. I mean, there are cancer types, there are particular cancers where, you know, we've developed targeted therapies. You know, chronic myeloid leukemia, for instance, was a disease that was very difficult. The entire, let's say, blood cancers, we've really seen a lot of improvement over the past sort of 10, 20 years in median survival. So we're a lot better at managing those diseases. And then there are other areas where we're really, really not doing well. You know, many of the brain cancers, glioblastoma, for instance, is really, we're really still as bad as we were 30 years ago. We've seen very little progress, to my understanding. And the hope is that in some of these areas, at least, CRISPR-based therapies might provide novel opportunities.
Yeah, I find the point interesting that you mentioned the drug that cures everything or all cancer types. So it always reminds me of J.R. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, the one ring that binds them all. I don't think that this will ever evolve. So that's one therapy can be used for everything. I see it more like adding additional tools to the toolbox of physicians so that they can treat their patients better on a more personalized way, rather than hoping that the cure everything drug that also makes pretty and rich comes to the market. I don't see that coming. Let's go a little bit further down the superstitious road. I really liked it. So, for example, the Marvel Universe with all the superheroes that can fly and have superpowers and super strengths. And this, I think, is one fear on the market or one hope on the market, so that you can go to your physician and say, today I would like to fly. Can you edit my genome a little bit so that I can ignore gravity and the laws of physics? Is something really possible that the Marvel Universe is coming to life with gene editing, or is this just a fear that should not be taken so seriously?
I would say yes and no. I think the problem with CRISPR, as with any cell and gene therapy, is always delivery. Meaning, you know, if you could do something, if you could get access to certain cells, then you could potentially manipulate them and you could potentially improve them, right? So I give you an example of that. There is at least suspicion in sports that, you know, people, instead of taking erythropoietin, which is one of the drugs that people take to improve their fitness, they might actually deliver erythropoietin through molecular biology, right? And that's totally plausible for a molecular biologist to see that. You don't even need CRISPR for that. You might take a virus that makes erythropoietin and you put that into the blood cells of an athlete. That will have very similar effect as taking that drug, right? So I think it's possible, but here, you know, in the case of the athlete, you know, you do this in a blood cell. So in a blood cell, I think it's feasible because you can access the blood. There is also a safety net, if you like, because you could potentially take the blood out, do the treatment, and only when it's safe, you put it back. Now, I'm not advocating that we do this with erythropoietin for sportsmen, but I'm trying to illustrate that you can manipulate the blood potentially, and you could potentially create superhumans if you wanted to stay in that picture. With a lot of other things, it's very difficult. With a lot of other traits, it's very difficult to envisage that. Right. If you think you could make someone more intelligent, right? If you believe that intelligence resides in the brain, which we possibly all believe, then you would need to get something into the brain and you would potentially need to affect a lot of cells and a complicated wiring. So to believe that a simple change in a cell, you know, would change your ability to think, let's say, I find that very unrealistic. So I think that the main limitation will be, on the one hand, our understanding of the process. And if you stay in the example of intelligence, that's probably a very complicated thing to understand. It's regulated by a lot of different genes. It's regulated by the environment, their genetic changes, epigenetic changes. To believe that there you could make one change and suddenly become super intelligent is close to impossible, or at least very unlikely. But a simple change, coupled, presence or absence of erythropoietin coupled with an accessible tissue like the blood, I think that's a possibility. And obviously that's why then organizations like NADA, which are looking at drug abuse in sports, have started to look at that, because it's a possibility. And they might be a few years behind the athletes in that sense, but they will look at that and they will hopefully sort of find these cases and make sure they don't happen.
I mean, there are a lot of interesting ideas on the market these days. So one idea is from Elon Musk, and I think also Jeff Bezos is buying into that, flying to the moon or flying to the Mars and putting a colony on Mars. And it reminds me of a book I have read when I was a teenager. It was a science fiction book about written for teens, about a family who traveled to a distant planet and with a little bit, let's say, different environments than the Earth, and it was hardly survivable for adults because they didn't have proper genetics for that. But the kid was genetically engineered to live in a hostile environment, like normal human beings on the planet, which when I listen to Elon Musk, where he says, okay, the future of the human race is in the stars and we have to leave the planet at some point in time to ensure the survival of our race. Would it be possible in future, what do you think, so that you can create genetically enhanced human beings that can also survive conditions on other planets that are currently, let's say, a little bit hostile? Or let's not think too scientifically, science fictionifically. For example, also on Earth, I mean, we have this climate change that everybody's talking about. Would it be possible to also, over generations, develop the genome in a way that we don't have to fear our race to go extinct? Is that a possible application, or is this still science fiction?
Well, I think first, you know, personally, I'm more worried about technology killing the human race than technology saving us. But maybe that's my pessimism. But then I think what's possible is, for instance, you know, genetics determines your tolerance to heat, right? It's clear mm-hmm. that there is a genetic component to that. I haven't looked into that, but I suspect it's not just one gene that has a very strong effect, but it's sort of, or one SNP, one sort of small change, but it's multiple. So I think if that were known, it's not unthinkable that we create humans that can tolerate cold much more. If you think of, you know, going to Mars, maybe we want someone that can tolerate heat better or so. Mm-hmm. So it's, I think that if you really think in the future, I think it's a possibility. Again, at this point, I would question if you sort of want to make very few changes to the genome, and that would sort of be dictated by caution, right? You just want to, I think if you made too many changes, you're worried about messing something up fundamentally. But if you wanted to make very few changes in the genome, then you would need to understand what those changes are that you need to make. And those few changes, let's say, if you allow five, those five changes would have to have a significant impact, which, you know, if you stay in the example of heat and cold, I would suspect it's a lot more SNPs that give rise to that. But I think at least conceptually, it is possible that we get to a point where we have, you know, with more and more genomics data coming in, where we have a good understanding of the small changes that make, you know, the Inuit more cold resistant than us, let's say, and that we can engineer such a property back into our genomes to sort of potentially save us from climate change, right? That's, I think it's potentially possible.
I think the ideas you have are great. On one hand, understanding disease better. So when not genetic, but the entire genomics field, to understand where it's coming from, what happens with diseases, to go into therapeutics, and so also curing diseases or enhancing human beings. Why not? I would not be worried about it. When I look at the growth rate of the human race, I think correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's doubled in the last 40 years or something, and it's still growing. So we run into, when you look at agriculture, for example, I think it's obvious that at some point in time we run into a shortage of nutrition. Could gene editing play a role in this area?
Yeah, I think potentially I would say yes. Again, my personal feeling is that there is a lot more we could do without gene editing to feed the world. But if you wanted to look at that angle, I think, you know, in agriculture, we're sort of facing this weird situation that if we're making crops with ionizing radiation, like X-rays, right? We're shooting X-rays at plants to sort of create superior variants, then this is sort of not considered genetic engineering. Whereas if we apply CRISPR or sort of other means to make a plant, then this is considered genetic engineering. So I think particularly in Europe, people are quite resistant to the use of genetic engineering, and I think rightfully demand that this is declared. I would totally subscribe to that the consumer can decide whether or not they would like to eat a genetically modified tomato. At the same time, you would like to educate people that if the other tomato that they eat is engineered with X-rays, that is probably not much better. But anyway, I think to come back to that question, we can definitely enhance plants to become, for instance, resistant to certain pathogens, to become resistant to heat, right? Mm-hmm. That's another, you know, or become more resistant to extreme weather conditions. Those are things we could potentially build in, and we could always build them in, right, with the use of X-rays, as I just said. So people have done that for the past 50 years, but it's very costly and laborious and time-consuming process. So the hope would be that if we have an understanding of where these favorable traits are encoded, that we can make these changes much faster. And we can then get to the plants that that we like and that have superior attributes. So I think gene editing can help there. And I would even say that I would prefer eating a gene edited tomato that was made with CRISPR over an X-ray tomato, possibly. But yeah, I think that's another interesting and exciting area of the technology that I'm not sure to what extent this will allow us to feed the world, because of course all of these crops, particularly genetically engineered crops, they will be accessible to us, right? You and me, they will not be accessible necessarily to in the places where people are starving. So
one problem at a time, I think. One is the development of technology, and the other one is the distribution or the fair distribution of technology.
That's true. And that's disconnected. Yeah.
I mean, when I think about SARS-CoV-2, what I really like is the development speed that we saw with the vaccines. I grew up in a world where, you mentioned it also in the podcast, it took a minimum of 5 to 10 years from the lab bench with, let's say, lead candidate up to the market. And what we really saw in the last year is when everybody works together globally and wants to solve a problem, in a year can be achieved a lot. If this is morally or ethically acceptable is a different question, but only to see that the whole industry can unite and focus on solving one single goal in only 12 months and bring a novel vaccine to the patients. This is amazing, and I hope that it remains in our industry, and also politicians and companies continue supporting this collaboration, because with that spirit, we can practically, my opinion, solve a lot of diseases and a lot of problems. The second part, of course, I mean, now the vaccines are on the market and now we see the distribution problematic. so that some countries can afford to get more vaccines and they start vaccinating kids, with a question if the risk-benefit profile really justifies that. Whereas the WHO points out that in poorer countries or not so rich countries, healthcare workers don't have access to vaccines. And this is the population that is highest at risk, and they would need that. So these are more political questions that we can also solve with a lot of debate and discussion. Speaking about SARS-CoV-2, let me just ask a blunt question. Is gene editing playing a role in vaccine development? Is this...
Well, I would say not to a great extent. I mean, first, it did play a role relatively early on, more for the discovery of targets. So when the virus first came out and nobody knew anything about the virus, something like a CRISPR screen, this is the technology that we use at Alien, can provide you very quickly with an understanding of the critical host proteins, so the critical human proteins that the virus needs to make a living, right? So you, and that is what people did, you know, I would say within 2 or 3 months, we had almost like a map of the virus as it sort of travels through cells and sort of uses cells and abuses cells to its own benefit. And that is important because it potentially highlights intervention points. It highlights points where we could start making a drug. Now, of course, then making a drug is again a laborious process. We've been very fast with the vaccine, essentially because the entire platform had been set up by BioNTech, right? That was, we were sort of in a particularly fortunate situation in that they had been building this mRNA platform, which was very scalable, easy to make very large amounts. And they had prepared this for some time, but the truth is they didn't really have a very good example where they could apply this, right? And they're now saying, oh, we want to be an immuno-oncology company. But the truth is that they were sort of waiting for a first example to be sort of the first test case that would show that the advantages of the platform. And I think, you know, then sort of SARS-CoV-2 came and they were immediately sort of spot on and said that this is the sort of the use case we've been waiting for, and we'll now show the world that we can do this. And then, of course, it was amazing execution, and it was very well done. With the vaccine development, I'm not fully sure there is a lot that CRISPR could have contributed. Again, you know, you sort of vaccine development it always has to do with the immune response that the vaccine elicits. So again, one could take CRISPR screening technology to understand the immune response as it is elicited by the vaccine a bit better, to sort of give an expectation of what's going to happen in the human body. Yeah, I would say, at least in sort of when this virus first came out and nobody knew about it, that's where, you know, CRISPR was really powerful.
I mean, as far as I remember, we have every 3 to 5 years such an event that new viruses appear somewhere in the world. And what I understand from your explanation is that in such events, your technology that you have at Alien Biotechnology can help to, unlock the secrets or discover the secrets or uncover the secrets of the virus. What is the virus doing in the body? Which route does it take? Where can you find access points for therapies? And that you can shorten the length of the time until this process is finished. So this would be one point. And also later on, when vaccines are developed, as far as I understand your explanation, it also can help your technology to understand what's the vaccine doing in the body, and is it really going down this, the right route, and can help the scientists to make the vaccines more effective in later generations. Is that picture correct that I got?
Yeah, no, I agree. With the only caveat being that sort of the drug target nomination, I think, for SARS-CoV-2 was something that's relatively quick. And of course, then the delivery of a full drug discovery program is something that we're still sort of awaiting, right? Even, you know, we've been very quick with the vaccine, but it will probably take, you know, at least one, if not three more years until we have a first drug that is a targeted treatment for the virus entering the clinic, right? That is usually a very laborious process, and that really cannot be short-circuited. There is really a lot of tests that just need to be done. And even with all the excitement and all the concern that we have of this virus causing the pandemic, nobody would be willing to take shortcuts there, right? With the vaccine, it was a slightly different thing. We knew that the platform was relatively safe. You know, mRNA is a molecule that's quickly degraded. It does not integrate anywhere in the human body. So there, you know, people were, let's say, willing to, I wouldn't call it shortcuts because they have done all the clinical testing properly, but it's right? There, people were willing to accelerate things with sort of more conventional drug discovery and more conventional drugs. This is just not possible.
Yeah, shortcuts is such a nasty word. It could create the impression that work was not done properly. When I look at the duration of drug development, my opinion, it's one part that takes a lot of time is fundraising. So when you look at the traditional model, I mean, all the early stage development work usually happens in small biotech companies like yours, not so much in the pharma industry anymore. And even if it happens in the pharma industry, you have these long decision-making processes. I think what I saw last year with my fundraising experience for vaccine companies from 6-7 years ago, that there was much more willingness to pay into high-risk projects in the vaccine space, which, of course, I mean, if I got $1 billion cash in my bank account, I can develop a vaccine also in no time because I can hire all the right people. Looking back at the traditional fundraising process, it's just comes in chunks. So it gets 10 million, 20 million, then another 50 million. Then you have always a year in between where you have to talk with experts and go through the diligences. And this, of course, takes away resources for development. So this also adds time, and this was completely gone in the last year. The only thing that I saw is that all the money and all the political power was rooted into vaccine development and nothing happened on the therapeutic side. So it's only recently that Biden announced that, I think it was 2 weeks ago or 1 week ago, that the United States allocates $3 billion into development of therapeutics. And I also hope that Europe is going down the same route, because when we also would invest $3 billion, it's basically $6 billion is the money that we have to pay as a minimum to bring two therapies to the market. And if this $6 billion are really available and easily available to scientists, then I think also we can speed up the therapeutics development process. So this would just take one component out that costs a lot of time.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, the truth is that a lot of the therapeutic development happens in pharma companies. And my feeling is if they're convinced about the indication and they're convinced that they want to go down that route, they often have enough money. If it happens outside a pharma company, then you're right. Money is always short, right? It's also that you can hardly raise the amount of money that is needed for drug development. Hence, sort of any startup typically has a handover point in mind, right? They might say we have a therapeutic ambition in rheumatoid arthritis, but you know, typically we would only go until phase one that is completed, and then we need to find someone, because if we then need to fund a phase two or even a phase three study out of our own pocket, it gets so incredibly expensive that very few people are willing to take that risk. So that, you know, you could potentially alleviate by making public money available to sponsor this.
I mean, I agree with what you say. When I look at phase three studies or market access or phase four studies, pharma has enough money in that area. And I think this is also the part of the industry that works very well. What in my opinion also works very well, especially in Europe, is basic research. Everything that happens in research organizations, we have Horizon programs, we have FWF in Austria, we have FFG in Austria, and other grant programs that help basics researchers and scientists to move their science forward. Of course, I know applying for grants is a nasty process, and I never met a scientist who was really happy about the process, but of course, when the money comes in, it's great. And the good thing is, in basic research, scientists don't need billions. So they can do a lot with a few millions or a few hundred thousand euros. And this is also solved. What's really tricky and difficult, in my opinion, and I still see a shortage of capital, are the stages between. So what happens between basic research and, let's say, the proof of concept in human studies is a really complex value chain with a lot of players in it, and most of them lack capital, because on one hand, pharma doesn't really want to tap into uncertain technologies. Of course, I mean, when you have like CRISPR, yeah, when you have this game-changing technology, that is obvious. Pharma is very willing to invest very early. But a lot of inventions that are needed don't evolve out of game-changing technology. So sometimes there is this uninteresting technology, then you have by pure chance a finding and it makes it hot. So, and in this area, also VCs don't really want to invest. They don't want to pick up technology, form a team, and have to go through this company formation process. On the other hand, business angels, what I see in the digital world, expect usually a return within 1 or 2 years. So drug development is not really an attractive model for business angels. And also the public side doesn't really want to invest there. And I believe if from this 3 billion from Biden, and also if we take money from the European Union, if they would really start focusing in this complex, let's call it tech transfer processes or value of death, like it's called in finance. If they would allocate more money there, I think also a lot of companies would be enabled to move faster and quicker. How do you see that?
Yeah, I mean, it's not only a function of money, I would add here. I mean, as you rightfully pointed out, there are different programs and that are available, but it's really, if you are thinking big, and drug development always has to be thought of as a really very big and international game, then you have to think very international. This shouldn't be thought as a local play. I mean, you know all the numbers as an investor. I mean, typically these East Coast companies are started with 50 million plus, and that's the kind of play you have to compete with as an Austrian startup. So you have to think very carefully where you want to get your funds from. And this is the kind of competition and play you're into. So I'm not 100% sure whether kind of these public programs really can replace private funding. It's a fact that Europe is somehow different than the US here. The capital markets are not as evolved as in the US. That's the reason why the Austrian drug developers, if they really become big, look for a second or first listing at the US capital market, because simply there is much more liquidity there. Yeah. and more, but maybe also more educated investor base. I mean, when I worked in this financing scene, many cases I saw that the kind of investors that really could judge what is a good investment in the life science area is a kind of scarce resource. I mean, it's much better now in the IT space, but in biotech, it's still, at least compared to the US, it's a kind of limited number of people that really are able to understand deeply what the drug discovery company is about, and really to give a clear opinion whether it's worth to be listed on a capital market or not.
Yeah, my friends asked me in 2006 if I'm nuts. As I said, you're going in the life science industry. They pretty much said the same what you are telling me now. I think Europe is a great place to start a company, even in drug development, drug discovery, thanks to some public funding programs. And they make it really possible for scientists that don't have deep pockets. I mean, let's face it, there are not millions of billionaires on the market in the world. So you can also do a lot with 100 to 200,000 euros, given the fact that public money flows into that area. When I look at the venture scene, I think it's a directional decision by the founders that they have to make. Do they want to play the European single technology play of venture capitalists? There is not enough money in Europe, especially in preclinical development and clinical development. So the reaction of the VCs in Europe that I mostly saw was that they want to have a single asset in a single company, develop it to clinics, and then sell it as quickly as possible to the pharma industry. It's a just approach. It's I don't want to complain about it. But when I look on the United States, especially on key players also in gene editing, they have more a visionary approach, like CRISPR Therapeutics, for example. I mean, it was founded in Switzerland, but basically financed in the United States, in my opinion. And it's listed on the Nasdaq and also gets a lot of US money. When founders want to follow a visionary approach with a, let's say, a portfolio approach in the company with running a pipeline of 10, 20 programs, I don't see the right environment in Europe. I see the United States as the right cultural environment for such ambitions.
I agree, but I mean, I wouldn't see it that negative. I mean, if we look at BioNTech and other very prominent German examples, I mean, there are people with deep pockets like Mr. Hopp and the Strüngmann guys. They are around and they significantly helped these German Absolutely. Unicorn companies to really develop very well. And also in Austria, we have in the meantime, we have good examples of companies developing very well, like Hookkeeper and others. Mm. I mean, one can always discuss whether they were not Hookkeeper, but others were sold too early. That's did not get the full value of the of what they would be able to develop. But that's as it is.
But
and in addition, even if you are kind of company that started in Austria, you have the chance of getting listed in another market, be it UK, be it US, that has more liquidity and raise more funds there. I mean, we have several examples now where Vienna is kind of the R&D and hub of certain companies. Even US companies come to Austria and create the R&D department, R&D kind of part here in Austria, because we have so good a base of doing R&D here, and maybe do the commercial functions elsewhere. That could also be a model. In the end, it's always, and this was also mentioned last time, a function of experience of people that are around and available in our country and in Europe on a bigger scale.
No, that's true. And I see is also the upside that especially our business can be easily run globally. You mentioned Hookkeeper Pharma. I think Hookkeeper Pharma started in Switzerland, then relocated to Vienna and got listed on the Nasdaq and has now subsidiaries in the United States. So I think the headquarters in the United States, and still the research is done here in Austria. Also, I think Nabriva is an example, started in Vienna and then got listed on the Nasdaq. BioNTech, I think financed by Mick and their investors, who helped to evolve the company with significant investments, partnered up with Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, who also brought money in. And I think BioNTech is also listed on the Nasdaq. It just must be clear that at one point in time, when we're looking for 500 million, I still think that there are only very, very few investors here in Europe who have the capabilities of supporting that. And I always wonder if, when the European life science industry evolves, especially with the successes of BioNTech or Hookkeeper Pharma, that hopefully also we will get more and more investors that are located in Europe and fuel the talent.
No, I definitely agree. I mean, all this Corona phase definitely improved the case for good life science and biotech companies. I think this has increased the investor confidence a lot and made a very good case for investors that biotech and life science companies well deserve good investments. And I mean, we as biotech scene in Austria also have some room for improvement, but with the creation of the Biotech Austria Association, I really think that's a great step forward to also receive better public knowledge what the biotech companies can do for the society as a whole. Mm.
Now, hopefully we have room for improvement, otherwise life would get boring easily. So if there's nothing to do anymore. Talking about investments and pharmaceutical companies, what are the major players in your industry? What are the major players in gene editing these days?
I mean, obviously we have, it was already mentioned several times, CRISPR Therapeutics definitely is one of the large players, and all the other companies that are mainly in the US for now, like Intellia, but there are also some companies in Asia. But many also big pharma companies have now taken licenses for CRISPR technology from the different licensing consortia, and probably follow their own approaches. So I think CRISPR technology in the meantime is so broad a technology that it can be centered around single companies. That's definitely too big a topic. I mean, we haven't discussed the IP landscape yet, which is still stands in the way a bit of a even better development, a more efficient development of the whole CRISPR technology and CRISPR drug development scene, because as we all know, this is still somehow unclear how this whole IP battle will be resolved in the end.
Yeah, that was my comment as well, that initially there were sort of 2-3 big companies that were founded around the main patent estates, and the two competing ones here are the Charpentier-Doudna patent that go back to this sort of initial discovery that I described earlier, and then the reduction to practice in human cells, which was Fang Zhang from the Broad Institute. And sort of companies were found around those main patent estates. Initially, Editas was founded around the Fang Zhang portfolio, and then CRISPR Therapeutics and Intellia around the Doudna Charpentier portfolio. But it seems in the meantime, a lot of other companies have come up, and this question of who owns CRISPR and you need to have access to the foundational IP, because the technology is so groundbreaking and so important, has become almost, I wouldn't say a mute point, but in the early days of CRISPR, people were like, okay, you need to be either this or that company, because those are the two main patent estates. And if you don't have access, you don't even need to play in that market. But in the meantime, there are 15 other companies, is my impression. And eventually the whole IP situation will be sorted out, because it's so big and so broad, and there's so many applications that it just cannot be in the way that two universities are battling over that foundational IP.
I mean, I think as long as the companies are developing or doing research, the IP should not be the problem until market entry. And I really wonder what happens when the first company has developed a therapy that works and it cannot be brought to patients because of IP protection. So because there is an unwillingness of handing out licenses, it would be an interesting case to see how that will be resolved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I cannot really see that happen. First, the question is always sort of what exactly was claimed in these patents. That is, right? Initially, for instance, let's not go into detail there, but there, the precise formulation around the claims matters, whether you're inside or outside. So I think that there can potentially be workarounds. We've seen different nucleases other than Cas9 that could potentially be used. So I think there will be several technical solutions to solve the problems that you're trying to solve. So I would be really surprised if that ultimately was in the way. Also, I wonder if then University of Vienna or Berkeley or anyone would really like to see their name in the news stating that a new therapy for cystic fibrosis becomes available, but you're blocking it because people don't have access to CRISPR. I mean, that is very negative PR, and I'm really hoping that it doesn't go down that path, because it would be it would be sort of very tragic if that was the outcome, right? I can sort of see how you want to have certain stakes in the ground, I can also see how you want to have a share in the program if CRISPR is used to sort of make or break the therapy. But we're not facing a situation where a therapy gets shot down essentially because people don't have the proper licenses in place.
I mean, maybe I'm too positive, but as long as it's research, DIP is never a problem, in my opinion. If there is really a groundbreaking breakthrough that also coming from the investment side, also when I look at companies that have not secured the license, once you have the results, of course, I mean, out of courtesy, you should talk with the university who holds the IP and agree on licensing terms that are also beneficial for the basic researchers to move that forward. But I think the licensing terms are quite standard these days, and there are a lot of examples in the world, so that also when a licensing agreement cannot be found, I think with outside pressure from regulatory authorities, that might also be resolved beneficial for both parties. It might not be the lottery win, but I think it can be resolved. And I don't see a reason why a university should not give a license on commercial terms, but they should. No. It would make the money. Am I too positive?
I think this getting a therapeutic license for CRISPR is a very complicated process. So it's on the one side, the universities and the people involved have given this to certain specialized companies that commercialize this IP. On the other side, I think you mentioned some mandatory licenses, which are in certain patent laws. But we have this discussion with Corona vaccinations as well. And we have seen the discussions there. I mean, mandatory licenses, that's really, this goes deep into the heart of our commercial system and the biotech system. So, and I don't think there will be an easy solution to that, because this really would significantly impact the whole business model of biotech companies in a sense that, yeah, they cannot rely on the proper patent protection they absolutely need for commercializing their products they have discovered. I mean, the main problem we have these days is that it's not even clear to whom the knowledge belongs, because we have this interference process going on. We have several rulings going on at the EPO, European Patent Office. So this will, unless there is a kind of solution and via negotiation, if it's decided by court, this I would assume this will take several years until this is really resolved. And this will also lead to a situation where investors, when companies will shy away from this unclear situation and will not develop certain therapeutics where the licensing situation is unclear. Because if I'm an investor, I wouldn't invest in a case where it's unsure whether I can commercialize that technology.
That, I think that's a question worth debating. When I think about the origins of patent laws, they all evolved in a time where the internet did not exist, where traveling was really difficult and challenging. And also multinational collaborations were not in the day-to-day business. It was just, I think, 1800, 1700, 1600. So they have a very, very long history. Mm-hmm. And now we live in a connected world where it's really possible, also with more and more people on the planet, where it's really possible to connect huge teams over one topic and let them work to solve the same problem. So, and still we have these negotiation processes that just take a lot of time. And coming from a different society, from a different background. And when I think also from the investment side, when I think just start working, just move the therapy forward. I mean, 9 out of 10 or 99 out of 100 approaches won't work anyways. So should people start negotiating a license for a patent that probably is off patent before they can bring something on the market early on? Or should they just postpone the process and say, okay, let's find out first if it works. And if it works, then let's initiate the process and sometimes get also hopefully help in future that maybe there is an arbitrage authority that can help just shorten the timeline for the negotiation, not in, denying commercial benefits to one party, but just to streamline the process and make it move quicker. I think this would be very helpful.
I mean, I'm not talking about the kind of relatively cheap processes up to going into clinical phases. I was really talking about clinical studies that cost several hundred millions and more. And I think taking this huge commercial risk of entering such studies without having a clear situation on the whether an approval would be possible in the end with a proper license situation. Yeah, I doubt that this risk can be taken easily.
Because
think also of the licensing partner. If he knows that you absolutely need his license, he will have a very strong leverage of setting the bar for a proper license very high.
I mean, it's not in our industry, but I think the developer of Fortnite is battling over the access on Apple's App Store, which is basically a monopoly and patents create monopolies. I'm not aware of a case that really pushed it so far that they just developed something up to the end of phase three, invested billions of dollars without sorting out the licensing issues beforehand. But the question would really be, what would happen then? I mean, you have a therapy in the pipeline that works, and then the owner of the patent just blocks it and says, no, I don't allow it. It would be really interesting to have a debate over that. I mean, SARS-CoV-2 brought it up.
There's a huge debate in the US anyway going on about this patents in the CRISPR space, whether they belong to a bigger extent to the public, because obviously a lot of the research that led to this breakthrough discoveries was financed by public funds. And in the end, by the public, and whether the huge profits then should remain with the large university funds is definitely a big question, and should be considered carefully, because this is somehow unequal distribution of profits.
Thomas Tillmann, I really like having conversations, so we can go on also for another 3 hours, and I think I will never run out of ideas.
Don't threaten anyone here.
but I think you have two companies to run. And so I would suggest to wrap up our discussion, and I would like to ask you two one final question. You both have experience in the industry. You founded several companies. And there are so many people out there these days who think about going down the same routes that you did, but it's their first time. So let's just assume somewhere at the conference, hopefully in future again in person, you bump into a bunch of entrepreneurs from different age groups in their 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s who come up with the idea and tell you, look, I'm so impressed by what you achieved. I want to do something similar. I have an idea. Can you please give me one advice? What would that most important advice to those people be from you?
That's a tough one, Thomas. I leave you the first
one. Yeah. No, for me, it's relatively clear. I think the best advice would be to really form a proper team, to team up with people whom you can trust and who bring in different competences, different networks. And if you have built a great team of two or three people, then that's already one of the best bases you can have for forming a successful and sustainable company.
Yeah, I think it's a very tough question. Put me a bit on the spot. But I don't know. I would probably advise to really, you know, first try to be very specific about what you want to do and try to really focus on a very small thing. But then with this very small thing, try to develop an idea that you really think has an impact. So this whole concept of focus, I think, is one that we always try to emphasize, that we're trying to do one thing really, really well, as opposed to working at a lot of disconnected or loosely connected things. But I'm not sure I find that a very good piece of advice. So I'm It would have to be a longer conversation for it to be meaningful, I think.
We can make another podcast on that, but you nailed it very, very well. Focus is the most important thing for success of any company. And later on, when you succeed in one field, you can then, of course, diversify and grow bigger like Amazon. But Amazon initially, I think it's a company everybody knows. They did just one thing, selling books over the internet. That's it. And both advices, form a team and focus initially on one idea, become the best in that field, is what made Jeff Bezos the richest person in the world, ultimately, after 27 years. So sound advice from you too. Thank you very much for your time and these nice conversations. I think it helped a lot for non-scientists to understand better what gene editing is, what the power of CRISPR is, what the risks and opportunities are, and also hopefully we contributed a bit to the awareness of the life science industry, and hopefully also one or the other politician is listening to that and helps moving forward the regulations around patent laws and help also with bringing the right laws in place that our community here in Europe can evolve better. Thank you very much for your time and have a great day.
Thank you, Christian. Thanks a lot for organizing that. Have a nice day.
Thank you. It's a great
day.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. Please, please share the podcast and make sure you've subscribed. Have a great day.